Good evening. We have many more folks who will be coming in, but y'all are on time, so we'll go ahead and get going here. It's my pleasure to introduce to you, if many of you don't need an introduction, but Bruce Miller is representing Acts of Faith. Bruce, if I remember what I was told correctly, the founding producer of Acts of Faith and the Virginia Repertory Theater. Is that correct?
Very close, yes.
And I also found very close. Well, you can just correct whatever I'm about to say from here on out. Acts of Faith is the nation's largest faith-based theater festival here in Richmond. And so we are really excited to hear about this year's offerings and maybe some ways that we can partner around this great festival. So Bruce, come share with us, and folks will continue to filter in, but we want to let you have the full time to talk to us tonight. Thank you.
Sure. And 45 minutes is my magic time, right? All right.
More or less.
More or less. Okay. Well, we'll see how it goes. All right. I always put my watch here. I don't have too much trouble being too short. I definitely have trouble being too long, and so I have to watch. Well, I can watch that clock to make sure I don't go over here. I am the founding producer at Virginia Repertory Theater. I was the artistic director there at Theater 4 and at Barksdale, and then when they merged at Virginia Rep, for a total of 44 years. And now I have shifted over to the title of founding producer, and I actually also have another new job that I start in a couple months. The time had come at Virginia Rep, and I say this with all respect and affection, to give the guy who replaced me, Nathaniel Shaw, a little more elbow room. He had gotten to the point where it's like, do I really have to have the old guy hanging around here anymore? And I'm not one to hang around when I shouldn't be hanging around. So I had an opportunity to accept the position of executive director of the Chesterfield Cultural Arts Foundation. So I have accepted that position. I'll be starting that in June or July. And my last day full-time at Virginia Rep will be March 29th, which is opening night of Pinocchio, which I wrote and am directing. But I'll still be at Virginia Rep, you know, on and off. It's my baby, and, you know, I will always be there. The Acts of Faith Festival is in its 15th year. I am not the founding producer of that. The real founder of Acts of Faith Festival is a fellow named Jeff Gallagher, who was a member of the congregation at Second Presbyterian. He got together with another guy from Second Presbyterian named Daniel Moore, and they said, what we lack in the United States of America is civil conversation, and we need more civil conversations. Why don't we use theater as a mechanism to promote civil conversation around various issues? Now, some people, when we first started, thought, oh, this is the Acts of Faith Festival, so they're gonna do Man for All Seasons about Sir Thomas More, and they're gonna do plays about Joan of Arc. We actually did do one of those. And plays that wear their faith on their sleeve. But we found out, since there are 12 participating theaters and since the Acts of Faith Festival has been going on for 15 years, the number of plays that wear their faith on their sleeve, you run out pretty quickly. And you have to start finding plays that prompt faith-based discussions but don't necessarily have a nun as the central character. So most of the plays that are done now are not about saints or sinners, but they're about regular, everyday people encountering the same problems that we encounter, and we hope that they will prompt faith-based discussions. I want to thank your congregation for being a supporter of the Acts of Faith Festival for the second year. I think it's a wonderful thing that you all are joining with us. I understand that you're going to see three shows, and if you haven't signed up for one of these three yet, I hope that you will sign up for one of them. Some of your congregation, or all three of them, actually, some of your congregation is going to go see Once, which is the play at my theater, Virginia Repertory Theater, downtown, And it opens this Friday, and it is wonderful. If you like Irish music, if you like a poetic love story, but it's not that poetic. It's got a lot of rousing music in it. Then that would be one to come see. It's about two, a man and a woman in Ireland, in Dublin. She is Polish. She's a Polish immigrant. He is an Irish gentleman who has just broken up with his girlfriend who's moved to America. And they meet and fall in love with very complicated results. But I think it's a half the Book of Ruth and half the Good Samaritan. And you have to figure out which one is the Samaritan and which one was beaten up by the robbers. But you will find that out during the course of the show, and I think it will prompt lots of faith-based discussions for those inclined to have faith-based discussions. The other play that a group from here is going to see is called, one of the other two, is called Molly Sweeney. It is being presented at Gaydenkirk Presbyterian Church. It's by an Irish playwright named Brian Friel. I think he actually says Brian Friel, or did. He's no longer with us. And it's a play about a woman who has been blind from birth, and then through a miracle operation, her sight is restored, and what that does to her life and her marriage. And it's not all peaches and cream. It causes lots of good things and some challenges. I'm not going to presume, because it's not a play that we're doing, what they say the faith-based discussions are about, but it's certainly a story that I think could prompt faith-based consideration. And the third one that you all are going to see is called Every Brilliant Thing. It's presented by Hat Theater, which is way out west on Patterson Avenue. Tiny little theater, probably our smallest theater of the participating theaters. And it is about a young man whose mother was clinically depressed, winds up committing suicide or attempting suicide, and he starts making a list to comfort her of every brilliant thing he can think of, every wonderful thing that is meant to cheer her up. And then the list expands as he lives the rest of his life. Chris Hester stars in that show. And I think all three of them have the opportunity to be very thought-provoking. And that's all I'm going to say tonight about the Acts of Faith Festival. Because what I'm really talking about tonight is a speech that I gave a year ago in two weeks when I was asked by the Northside African American community to come deliver the annual I Have a Dream speech for Martin Luther King Day. And I said, why on earth are they asking me? I was the first white guy that they ever asked to deliver the Martin Luther King speech. It was in one of the East End African American churches. I can't remember which one. And the whole audience, it was a who's who of Richmond's African American community. And I was terrified. but it wound up being just really terrific. And what I told them at the time was, I grew up in the 60s. Michelle went to college with me, and Laura Lee, Carl went to high school with me. And I was definitely on the liberal side of racial issues, and I thought that was a great place to be. At least I perceived myself to be there. And I thought race relations were going to be relatively easy. All they required was everybody loving everybody and having respect for everybody. And if we did that, things would go well, and they would just get better and better and better. As I have lived my life since then, I have found that that's probably the farthest thing from the truth, that race relations are never easy. Racial reconciliation is never easy. It is always complicated, as we are finding out this past week in particular, and as I have found out at various points in my career. Theater in Richmond, I'm very proud to say, has been a catalyst for some serious racial reconciliation over the last 50 years of Richmond history, or last 100 years. And I want to talk a little bit about that because I have found that to be very informative. Now, my text for today is a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail. And later on in my presentation, I'll tell you why I happened upon this quote and why it really resonated with me. And actually, Dr. King made this quote in a few different formats, so you may have heard it with slightly different words, but they all go pretty much like this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. We are tied together in the single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, and whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be. This is the way God's universe is made. This is the way it is structured. And that's a quote from the letter from a Birmingham jail. Now, if you know very much about that letter, you know that he wrote it because when he was leading the Children's Crusade in Birmingham, a group of Birmingham pastors, some of whom were African-American, said, why is this outside agitator coming into Birmingham to just make things more difficult for us? And so Dr. King wrote the single garment of destiny. We are all connected to each other in a single garment of destiny. He wrote that passage. He wrote it on toilet paper. The letter from a Birmingham jail, he asked for a pen and paper. He wasn't given a pen and paper. So he scrounged up a pencil and he found some toilet paper and he wrote the letter on toilet paper and then smuggled it out of the jail. Now, I have at various points in my life looked up the word garment to find out, well, what is a garment? I think I know what a garment is, but let's check it out. And I found out that the word comes from a French word, an ancient French word, and I'm going to say it wrong, garnement, all right? G-A-R-N-E-M-E-N-T, which means two things. It means equipment or to equip, and it means armament or to arm. So our garments are that with which we equip ourselves to go out into daily life, and that with which we arm ourselves to protect ourselves from daily life. And Martin Luther King, I have no idea whether he was relating to those definitions or not, but he's saying we are all connected with each other in a single garment of destiny, because I cannot be what I'm meant to be, who I'm meant to be, until you are allowed to be who you are meant to be. He wasn't cottoning to any of this talk about being an outside agitator. He said, no, I'm not an outside agitator. I'm here to help because I know that we're all connected to each other. Now, I'm going to go back to my story here. When I was in seventh grade at Crestwood Elementary School, we didn't have middle schools back then. I went from seventh grade in Crestwood Elementary right to eighth grade with Carl Collier and Huguenot High School in Chesterfield County. And I had a teacher named Bernard Schutte. It was one of God's great gifts to me. And Mr. Schutte was a brand new teacher. And in his spare time, Mr. Schutte literally lived at Hanover Tavern and worked in the evenings at Barksdale Theater. Well, I didn't know very much about theater, but on the first day of school, I spoke more than I should have or something. Mr. Schutte called me up to his desk and he pulled a paper out and he said, Mr. Miller, this is the recommendation about you that was sent to me by your teacher last year, Mrs. Pipin at Bonaire Elementary. And as you will see right here, it says that you are a problem child. All I remember about Mrs. Pipin ever saying anything like that to me directly is she used to write, I was too loquacious in my report card. So I went right home and looked up loquacious and found out that it meant I talked too much. And I went, well, you know, that's objective. We have to be objective about this. Maybe I talk just the right amount, you know. But anyway, Mr. Schutte said, well, maybe you got away with that stuff in Miss Pipin's class, but I'm letting you know on the first day of class, you are not going to get away with anything with me. I am a new teacher. I am tough as nails. And if you think you're going to pull one over on me, you've got another thought coming. Well, I loved it. It's like we were talking about with Mrs. Waymack in high school. I have always responded well to authority. I like it when people tell me they're the boss and this is what I have to do to toe the line. I don't know why. It's just I should have been in the army or something. I don't know. So I worked really hard to impress Mr. Schutte. And he started giving me all these creative things to do, bulletin boards and writing plays. I wrote a whole play about John Brown. And I got very excited about the work we were doing. And about two-thirds of the way through the year, he called me up and he said, you remember that first day when I told you that Mrs. Pipin said you were a problem child? And I said, absolutely. And he said, I have decided you are not. You are not a problem child. You are an artist. And that's your problem. And, he said, but if you find the right way to put that energy out there into the world, you'll do just fine. But in the meantime, make sure you study, you know, math and all this other stuff. And when he told me that, my soul just caught fire. The other thing that he did for me was he took us all out to Barksdale Theater to see a show. And afterwards, we got to sit down with Muriel Macaulay, who was one of the founders of Barksdale. And I was in seventh grade, and I was very impressionable. And she was telling stories, and one of the stories she told was about discovering the Jim Crow laws in Virginia. Muriel was one of six actors in New York City who read a book called Theater in the Round. And that book said, what we are going to do, American theater community, is we are going to decentralize American theater. We are going to start regional theaters in all of these communities that don't currently have professional theaters. And it's not going to be amateur. Everybody's going to get paid. And we're going to start these because we're working on the decentralization of American theater. And Muriel and five of her friends said, this sounds great. Let's do this. And so one of the five, Stu Falconer, had a mother who lived in Henrico County. And the mother said, oh, sure, Stu, you and all your friends come live with me, and you can start a theater here in Richmond. Little did she know. But they all moved down into the empty nest that Stu had earlier left of Mrs. Falconer's house. And they began looking for a place to start their theater. And eventually, they found Hanover Tavern. They bought it for $25,000. They were able to put $2,500 down. It was completely falling apart. There was no glass in the windows. There was no indoor plumbing. There was no heat. There was no, Lord knows, no air conditioning. But they thought they had found the perfect place for their theater in the round, the English basement of Hanover Tavern. And as they were repairing the building and getting ready for their first production in 1954, someone said, told them about the Jim Crow laws in Virginia, which at that time said that black people and white people could not sit together to watch a play in the same room at the same time. That was the law. Well, these New Yorkers went, heck with that, you know, we're not going to do that. So Muriel and Pete Kilgore and the others wrote to the president of Virginia Union University. Now, this is before the lunch counter sit-ins. It is before almost every civil right event you've ever heard of, all right? They wrote to the president of Virginia Union in 1954, and they said, we're starting a new theater in Hanover, Virginia, not the liberal hot spot of Virginia. And we would like to invite you to bring 40 people, 20 of your best professors, 20 of your finest students, to come and see our show at Hanover Tavern, at Barksdale Memorial Theater, it was called then. And come as our guests, we'll give you free tickets, and you'll be sitting side by side with all of the white Hanoverians coming to see the show. And then because they had a little lunch counter business during the afternoons, they started spreading the word that they had done this because they knew that it would get to the sheriff of Hanover County, whose office was directly across the street from the theater. And sure enough, one day, they're sitting there building scenery and have their sleeves rolled up, and there's this knock on the door. So they go out into the tap room and open the door, go up the steps and open the door out to Route 301, and there's the sheriff of Hanover County. And Muriel says, "Sheriff, so good to see you. The lunch counter has closed." And he went, "No, no, no, I'm not here for that. I'm here on official business." And she said, "Well, what can we do for you?" And he said, "Well, number one, I just want to say," and here's this story that she's telling us, we seventh graders, as we're sitting around her feet in Hanover Tavern. Said, "You know, I just heard that you all have invited a group from Virginia Union to come to your play. Now, I think what you're doing here is great. You are really fixing up the tavern. We love you guys. I know you're from New York, but that's okay. You're fixing up the tavern. You're bringing the community together. The lunch, the tuna salad sandwich, top drawer, you know." He said, "But we have this law called a Jim Crow law in Virginia." I don't know whether he said that. He said, "But I hear you've invited these people from Virginia Union University, and you can't do that." And Muriel said, "Well, absolutely, we have invited them. I'm glad you heard about it, but tell me about this law," acting like she didn't know. And he said, "You know, the law in Virginia says that white people and black people can't sit in the same room together and watch a play." And Muriel said, "Well, that's just the stupidest law I ever heard of. That's a law?" And he went, "Absolutely." And she said, "Well, that's a shame. Well, what are you going to do when we have this bus pull up and 40 of the top professors, or 20 of the top professors, or 20 of the top students come in and sit down to see our play?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to have to come over and arrest you, so you need to cancel the invitation." She said, "Oh, no, we're not going to cancel the invitation. But you know where to find us. And if anything comes about that you think is causing danger in the community, you be sure to come over and do whatever you have to do." Now, in 1954, them was fighting words, because they did not cotton to this type of disrespect of the law in Hanover. And the artists at Barksdale fully expected the sheriff and his deputies to come over and arrest somebody and haul them off for the night across the street. So they did the performance, the bus pulled up, 40 people get out, sit down, watch the show. It's called Gold in the Hills. The white people there loved it. The black people there loved it. Everybody went home. Everybody was happy. And nobody got arrested. The sheriff fell asleep that night and just, you know, pretended that it never happened. Well, after that happened, word spread throughout the theater community, because, you know, theater community, we're a bunch of crazy liberals, and all around Virginia, saying that Barksdale Theater had broken the back of the Jim Crow laws right here in Hanover County, of all places. Well, when Muriel told that story, I just thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I was always looking for, how can I make a difference? How can I mean something in this world? And here was this young woman who clearly was making a difference, clearly was defying a law that was clearly wrong by everything we in the Christian church have been led to believe. And she was introducing love into the situation, as we are commanded to do, and she got away with it. So I thought this was great. Then I went to vocational guidance. My church, Forest Hill Presbyterian, decided they were going to send all of us to vocational guidance training when we were in the eighth grade so that we could find out what to study in college and what career we should go into. And I took the vocational guidance test, and the only question that I can remember is one of them said, "Which would you rather go see, a ballet or an execution?" I went, "Well, that's easy." I've never been to a ballet. I'm not particularly attracted to a ballet, but I'm pretty sure I don't want to go to an execution. So I checked ballet, and then I followed that same way of thinking, apparently, for the rest of the test. And when the test was over, the counselor calls you in, and you sit down with them. And he said, okay, here are your results. Well, you scored very high on the feminine chart. So we're going to look at the women's professions, you know, for you. Well, I wasn't thrilled to hear that. You know, I was in eighth grade, and not overly, you know, I hadn't started shaving yet. You know, it was just, it was very sad. But I listened patiently, and I had thought that I wanted to be an English teacher. I had been watching Mr. Novak on TV, and Mr. Novak every week would go into his inner city high school and solve every problem that there was to be solved, every single week. And that appealed to me, and I was going to be Mr. Novak. And I said, well, I want to be an English teacher. And he went, no, that's never going to work for you. And I said, why not? I think I'd be a good teacher. And he said, you will love to teach the kids who want to be in the classroom, but you will find yourself incapable of teaching the kids who don't want to be in the classroom. And I thought that was utter nonsense. The profession that he picked out for me, and I swear on the Bible, this is God's truth. He said, your number one profession, this is in 1965, I think, is shepherd. So here I was, destined to be a female shepherd. I went home from vocational guidance very, very sad. But then after shepherd, he said, you like taking care of people? Maybe social work. If the shepherd jobs are all taken, maybe social work. And actually, I have sort of pursued social work. And ministry was on my list of things. It's a feminine job. What can I say? You know? And the deal was with the ministry, my grandfather was a Mennonite minister. My father was a Presbyterian lay leader. My brother became a Presbyterian minister, but then went kind of off the charts and now is an evangelical minister, non-denominational. And I didn't want to do that, and I knew I didn't want to do that. Never occurred to me theater. Didn't even cross my mind. So then I graduate from college, and I'm offered this job in Cortland, Virginia. Cortland is in Southampton County. It is literally the peanut capital of the world, right? And I had just seen the movie Conrack about Pat Conroy going to this South Carolina island of black kids, and he was going to save the world, and he did. And I thought, great, racial reconciliation. This is me. I'm going to go be a shepherd in Cortland, and I'm going to save all of these kids. 85% of the student population was African American, and I thought that was great. Well, I got there, and literally my first weekend day in sunny downtown Cortland, I was walking down the sidewalk, and a group of young African American men were coming at me this way, and much to my surprise, they all stepped into the road, did everything but lay down a cloak for me to walk on. Because the way it worked in Cortland was white privilege ruled the day, you know, and I was very embarrassed by that. Then I went into downtown Franklin, and in 1974 in downtown Franklin, some of you may be from there, they still had a movie theater with a sign that was up that said colored entrance in 1974 at the Franklin movie theater. In the school system, I had a woman who was working for me as a secretary because my official job was director of cultural enrichment in Southampton County. And her name was Miss Williams, and she worked at the Dairy Queen. And one day I said, Charlene, I am going to come buy a hamburger from you on Saturday. And she said, oh, Mr. Miller, you can't do that. And I said, why not? She said, I work in the Black Dairy Queen. And in Franklin, Virginia, in 1974, they had a Black Dairy Queen and a White Dairy Queen that were two blocks apart from each other. So I went, and I thought, I'm a rabble-rouser. I listened to Muriel Macaulay's story, you know? I went to the Black Dairy Queen, and Charlene, who was behind, Miss Williams, behind the desk, was just terrified because I was breaking the cultural norm for that community. And she thought she was going to get in trouble. She thought I was going to get in trouble. And she just wanted me to leave. And so I left because I was in the Black Dairy Queen. Now, this is 1974 in Franklin, Virginia. One thing I learned early on is that the other person who had applied for my job in Southampton County, where 85% of the student population was African American, was Mrs. Harrison, who was the music teacher and had been the music teacher in the high school for like 25 years. And she didn't get the job. I got the job coming directly out of University of Richmond. Couldn't be whiter if I tried. And I got the job over Mrs. Harrison, who had been in the system for all these years. So I started out not on the best of terms with the African-American faculty members, although they grew to really be wonderful to me. But it took a while. At the end of that year, they said, well, we lost our grant, so we can't keep you on as director of cultural enrichment, but we will offer you an assistant principalship. But I decided, for a variety of reasons, that was not for me. And one thing I had learned while I was there, I had written to every arts organization in the Commonwealth of Virginia and said, what do you have that you can bring to my schools? And not a single arts organization had anything. So I thought, I'm going to start, dadgummit, I am going to start a company that brings programs into schools, educational theater programs into schools. And so I called Phil Whiteway, who had been my roommate in college, and he'd been a double major in theater and business. I was theater and English. And I said, why don't we start a theater? And he said, we don't have any money. We can't build a theater. He said, nope, we don't need to build anything. All we need to do is buy this $2,000 van that I have found. You'll have $1,000. I'll have $1,000. We'll put it together. We'll buy this van, and we'll start this touring company, and we will call it Theater 4. Because we're seeking four things. Artistic excellence is number one. Educational excellence is number two. Excellence in children's health, more about that in a moment, is number three. And excellence in community leadership, number four. Okay? So we started Theater 4. And the first year we grossed $17,000. And that was enough to pay everybody a little bit, except nothing to pay Bruce or Phil. So we worked as volunteers for the first year. The second year we doubled. We grossed $35,000. And again, enough to pay everybody a little bit, but nothing for Bruce and Phil. Third year, double again, $70,000, nothing to pay Bruce and Phil. So for 3 years, we earned our living as waiters and working the midnight cash control shift at King's Dominion, which had just opened. We got the King's Dominion job, actually sort of illegally. We saw a poster up that's at the law school at U of R saying they were looking for law school students. And we, to work cash control, because at that time you literally counted the money. They didn't have machines. And you counted it in the middle of the night. So we went and they said, are you from U of R? And we went, yep, because we'd gone to U of R. We never went to law school. But we said yes, and so we got the job. And so for 3 years, we worked every summer at King's Dominion. Now, finally, in our fifth year, we were starting to make a little bit of money. And we got to do our first adult audience season. It was not just kids' shows in the van. And we rented the Westover Movie Theater, and we built a little stage in front of it, and we picked a season that we thought had something for everyone. It was a little transparent. We did the Philadelphia Story because it was the most WASP show that we could think of. We did A Raisin in the Sun because that was the black show we knew about. And we did Diary of Anne Frank, and we called it Anne Frank because none of the Jewish people say Anne Frank. And that was for the Jewish audience. So it was a little something for everyone. And we were very proud of ourselves and thought, we are engaging in racial reconciliation. We're doing Raisin in the Sun. And it was great. Then, a couple years later, in 1986, we had the opportunity to buy what was the old Booker T. Theater on Broad Street. And everybody said, you don't want to buy the Booker T. Theater. No, you know, white audiences aren't going to go to the Booker T. Theater. That was the black theater during the Jim Crow era on the north side of Broad Street. And if you're a lifelong Richmonder, it's okay to be on the south side of Broad Street, but your parents told you never to go to the north side of Broad Street. Well, that was fighting words to us. We were revolutionaries, and so we thought we are going to buy the historic, what had been the Empire Theater. Now, here's the story with the Empire Theater. And I'm going to run out of time, but anyway, I'll talk fast. The Empire was built in 1911. It opened on Christmas Day 1911, which was the final day of the century of mourning for the Great Richmond Theater Fire of December 26, 1811. Now, during the century of mourning, ministers had all gotten up into their pulpits and went, see, 72 Virginians, including the sitting governor, died in the Great Richmond Theater Fire. It was the biggest urban disaster in world history at that time. This is God's way of telling us that theater is no good. Theater is evil. And so theater took a dive. Theater had been a big deal in Richmond. Virginia was actually an arts capital up until December 26, 1811. And then it was like, after the Great Richmond Theater Fire. So Moses Hofheimer, on the last year of the century of mourning, a Jewish entrepreneur said, I am going to break this century of mourning. I am going to build a new theater in Richmond. And because I want it to be very attractive, I'm going to build it in the fashionable West End, which was just west of First Street. You know, just where Broad Street changed from East Broad to West Broad, where 114 West Broad, okay? And because that's the entrance to Jackson Ward, which is the first community built after the Civil War by freed blacks, for freed blacks, I am going to find a way to integrate the theater. Now, if the Jim Crow laws were in place in 1954, you can bet they were in place in 1911. So Moses Hofheimer went to the Virginia General Assembly, and he said, here's the deal. We've already designed the theater. It has a third balcony, just like the Academy of Music does down the street. But unlike the Academy of Music and every other theater in Richmond, I do not want to reserve the third balcony for rowdy white men called the Gallery Gods. That's what was happening in every Richmond theater. The Gallery Gods, who were rowdy, low-income white men, sat in the third balcony, had their own entrance. He said, I want to do something different. I want you to change the law and let me admit African-American audiences into the third balcony. And they'll have a separate audience entrance, which is still there. We don't use it, but it's still there. They will have no bathrooms, but they will never cross paths with white people who will be in the orchestra section and in the first balcony. And the General Assembly went, okay, we'll do it. You sure it's a separate entrance? You sure they don't have bathrooms? Okay, then we'll let this happen. And so they did. They rewrote the law, and that started to become a Southern tradition throughout the South. There was a black entrance to an isolated seating section in theater after theater all throughout the South. But for Moses Hofheimer, it was a huge step forward in a progressive agenda because it was the first integrated theater post-Reconstruction. The acting company that he hired to come in from Broadway was made up of Lucille Laverne, who was a leading lady on Broadway, and Frank Morgan, a leading man on Broadway, and they came to Richmond to head the acting company, and they were doing great plays. Movies were starting to become much more popular than plays. So Lucille Laverne eventually went, you know, all the money's in theater, I'm going to move to L.A. So she did, and she got a job with Walt Disney as the voice of and the model for the Evil Queen in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So the woman who says, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the fairest? You know, that one. And then says, apple, won't you eat my apple? That's Lucille Laverne, who is head of the Lucille Laverne Acting Company and on the same stage that we trod today at our November theater. And Frank Morgan, what became of Frank Morgan when he moved to Hollywood? Does anyone know? He became the Wizard of Oz in The Wizard of Oz. And Captain Marvel and, you know, everybody else. So these were some top drawer people here, performing for black people up here and white people here and here. Then after they left, it turned into a movie theater, and then a guy named John Mitchell. Does anybody know who John Mitchell was? John Mitchell was the editor of the Richmond Mercury, which was an anti-lynching newspaper. He was a firebrand publisher. And he would go into, if anybody got lynched in Virginia, John Mitchell would show up there and he would write an article about it. He was an anti-lynching dynamo with the Richmond Mercury. And he thought, I'm going to buy a theater. So as live theater started dying out and they turned it into a movie theater, he said, I'm going to buy that one. And he bought from Moses Hoffheimer the historic Empire Theater. And there's much more to these stories that I just love to tell. And after a couple years, he said, you know what? Mary Pickford is starring in the silent film Pollyanna, and I'm going to show it at my Empire, is now called the Strand Movie Theater. And I am going to, on one Sunday afternoon, open the downstairs to African-American children and their mothers. And he did. And the place sold out like that. And every African-American family in Richmond dressed up in their finest clothes came to see Pollyanna. And after that day, white Richmond decided, you know, we're not going to go there anymore. And so eventually, the Empire Theater, now the November Theater, turned into the Booker T Theater, and that's why everybody was discouraging us from buying it in 1986. But we bought it, and in a way, we came full circle, because the first building that was integrated was now owned by a company who was working in strategic collaboration with Barksdale, which was the first theater to integrate. And ultimately, Theater 4 and Barksdale merged to form Virginia Rep. Now, the other things that we did was we hired the first African-American board president. Everybody said, you can't do that because your board president has to raise money. African-Americans can't raise money. And we said, yeah, but if we're going to fight this fight and walk this walk, we got to talk the talk, and or vice versa. And we have to have African-American leadership. So we convinced Martha Gilbert, who was the head of the Virginia Department of Children under the Wilder administration, to be our first African-American board president. And it worked great for us. And then we elected Laura Lee is on our board. In fact, she will be our chairman, next year? 2 years. Our board said, well, we like this. This is working well for us. And we were not only the first, but before another single major arts organization in Virginia elected an African-American board president, we had elected 7. And Dr. Monroe Harris, who served twice as our board president, just within the past few months, it was a huge news story because he became the first African-American board president of the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts. But he had had his 2 years, you know, working as African-American board president of Virginia Rep. So my last little piece of the story. I found out one day, when I'm late, okay, Buffalo Soldier. There was a guy named Jones Morgan who was the oldest surviving member of the Spanish-American War and last surviving Buffalo Soldier. I found out he lived 2 blocks behind the theater. I said, I got to go meet this guy. So I met him. I said, I got to write a play about this guy. So I applied for a grant, and we got a $60,000 grant to tour our production of Buffalo Soldier into Virginia schools. And Jeremy Lazarus in the Richmond Free Press, which was the black newspaper, wrote this scathing article. And I thought I was doing such a liberal white boy thing, which is what I was doing. And he said, once again, you know, a liberal white boy has taken the story of an African-American hero and is exploiting it for his own financial gain. So now this is not to elicit O's, although boy did I go, oh, you know. it's to say how complicated it is. And when we turn on the news, it is complicated. And we see, you know, today we find out that our attorney general is saying, well, yeah, I once put on blackface to be a rap singer, and our governor put on blackface to imitate Michael Jackson. And this is complicated, and I'm not going to take one side or another. It is complicated. Nonetheless, if we go back to our biblical lessons and what we are commissioned to do, we cannot avoid the fact that we are commissioned to be racial reconciliators, to bring together all people. It is never right to say there's us and then there are the others. And we won't let the others in, and we won't accept the others, and we will keep the others in their place. I knew when I was listening to Muriel McCauley when I was in seventh grade, and I had listened to my ministers, and I knew that she was right and the laws were wrong. And every step of the way, even when Jeremy Lazarus in the Free Press is saying he's exploiting this story for his own gain, I knew that the end game is, even with every bump in the road, we have to seek racial reconciliation, racial understanding. Yes, we're in a weird period of adjustment right now, where people say, 38 years ago, you did this. And you go, yeah, I did. Well, to hell with you then, you know? Despite the frustrations, despite the challenges, despite the difficulties, our task at hand is always to find the next way to make a step forward, because the last law that trumps all others, the most important law, is loving each other. And that's what we have to do. So when they said, will you deliver the Martin Luther King speech? I had written I Have a Dream, the life story of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And I had been inspired when I wrote it by this single garment of destiny. So I went back to that and I said, so here's how I try to live my life, is by this speech and going, I can never really be who I need to be unless you can be who you need to be. Now, figuring that all out is hard. Nonetheless, that is what we can do, and hopefully by going to see plays in the Acts of Faith Festival, we will have the opportunity to talk about these issues in a civil dialogue and say, this is how, as a community, we are all going to move forward. I am now at 49 minutes. I'm going to end. If anybody has any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. Okay, my work is done here then. Thank you.
Well, you said you didn't want to go into preaching, but that was one of the best sermons I've heard. We absolutely, amen to that. We are a couple minutes over. We have so enjoyed tonight, Bruce. I know some folks may want to visit with you. If you can stay a little bit and have some conversation, we'll put on a pot of coffee and just stay the night if we want to. But ask questions, find out more about the Acts of Faith. Our church does want to be one of the sponsors of the Acts of Faith. It's wonderful asset to our community. Wonderful ways we not only can have fellowship and social event together, but also encourage wonderful conversations about how God is calling us to make a difference in our communities. And thanks for that challenge, Bruce. God bless you on your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good night.